My brain hurts right now because these ideas are, they're pretty far out.
And I suddenly believe in aliens. Thank you very much.
Welcome, MythFits.
Hello, 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 MythFits. I'm Carrie Byron.
And I'm Tori Belacci. Thank you again for joining us. Carrie, do you remember there's a lot of videos out there right now talking about, did we land on the moon?
Oh, my God.
What are your thoughts?
Really? We did this on the show.
We tested it on the show.
We busted these myths. We went through it. Of course we landed on the moon. I know so many people in the space industry, like, yes, we landed on the moon. Are you gathering a bunch of myths for us to bust so that we can pitch a reboot or something?
I want to restart.
I feel like we did a good job when we went to NASA. It was kind of, it's funny how much interaction we had with NASA. You know, we would go into their wind tunnels or their vacuum chambers. And when we did that moon landing episode, I do remember sitting around even at lunchtime and we're drinking water. And they look at, they're like, how's that water doing? Like, fine. Like, do you know what that is? Like, what? Oh, yeah, that's reconstituted astronaut pee. Like,
but
you're drinking.
But it wasn't. They were just pranking us. That wasn't actual.
It was.
No.
It was.
No, they told us that to get a reaction out of us. But later the producers were like, no, we're kidding. Like, that was.
Nobody told me they were kidding.
Yeah, they were joking. We weren't drinking filtered urine.
I fell for that. I fell for that.
Imagine drinking somebody else's filtered urine? Like, drinking your own filtered is bad enough, but drinking somebody else's? Ugh. Yeah.
I feel like you could filter it enough that it would be okay. I feel like it's a possibility.
I remember we were doing one experiment where I think it was dropping a feather in a vacuum.
Yes.
And dropping a hammer in a vacuum.
Yeah.
The old gravity trick. And I remember they had this arm that you'd put your arm. It was a spacesuit and glove that, you know, I put my hand in and I could like pick up the hammer and drop it, pick up the feather and drop it. And I remember them saying, and I forget what I was saying. And one of the guys goes, don't, you know, be careful with that arm. And I was like, you know, cause I was messing around, like, you know, goofing off. And I was like, oh, is it expensive? He's like, yeah, that's about a $200,000 arm right there.
Oh, no, it was $500,000. Oh, yeah, because it was $500,000 because it was one for each arm.
Yeah.
Because you were, and like, I'm like, you were twisting the finger back going, tap out.
I was like, dang, that's crazy. Anyway.
Well, that episode was really fun to film. We've taken a couple of their experiments and incorporated them into the show. The one that Grant hated the most. Do you remember we made the seasickness chair, which was something that they used when they were training the Apollo guys? And it's, you know, we had a revolving pedestal and we put a chair on top of it that we bolted to it. And then there's four tennis balls around your head and you have to move your head back and forth and side to side in the same rhythm until you throw up. And, like, you know, you and I did it and we didn't get sick. So clearly we're the astronauts of the bunch. But then Adam and Grant just
lost it.
Their days were ruined. Grant,
they turned green.
It didn't take long before Grant was laying out on the ground. He's like, I hate this. And then because they were the winners of being able to get seasick, because we were applying it to seasickness myths, we had to get them seasick every single day to make them try seasickness cures. I think this was Grant's most hated experiment because every day he'd come into the shop and have to vomit.
You know what? I felt a little queasy, but I was like, there's no way I am going to admit that, because I knew we were going to be doing this for weeks. So I was like, there's no, even if I do get seasick, I'm not going to tell him, because I know I'm going to have to do this every single day.
I feel like MythBusters was a training for strength. There's so many experiments we did that were just experiments on your body. Like the cure for hot sauce. Remember that, like, every day we'd have to eat peppers, ghost peppers, until our tongues went numb. And then it was like Vaseline and all sorts of gross stuff.
So just to let the listeners know, we you know, we had like 12 things that we were going to test to see how you can beat a hot mouth from a chili pepper. And so it was like, okay, milk, beer, like you're saying, Vaseline. So we had all these things lined up. And so we started with the peppers, like all of a sudden, like it burned our mouth. It was horrible. But then as we continued, like our tongues just went numb. And so it turns out that your nerves in your tongue get fried from the chili oil. So you have to wait 24 hours for your nerves and your tongue to regenerate. So this one day experiment turned into 12 days of coming into the shop, grinding up chili peppers, taking a spoonful, letting it burn our mouth. And then we would test whatever that day's, remedy was. It was, when I smell habanero peppers, I want to vomit.
Well, you are already, in case you ever go on hot ones, you know what to do. You just like burn and wait for it to go numb, and then you can do it. You get, because you actually, weren't you the one that won the Hall of Flame when we went to the restaurant to see, we found the cure and we were just like, okay, we're going to get on the Wall of Flame, which is just eating their hottest dish. But all of us got so sick. I fell off first because I wanted to throw up. My mouth was burning so hard. You and Grant kept going because you two were so competitive. And then I think both of you were sick for like 24 hours.
Well, I just, after it was the sheer amount, because I got pad thai. So I had this giant plate of pad thai. And I'm like, why? I should have ordered something, a smaller dish. And so I was like, I am going to get on the Wall of Flame. But after I was done, I ran to the bathroom and threw up because it was too much food and it was like all spicy. And then not to mention on the way out, a couple of days, the next day, if it's hot going in, it's hot coming out. Let me tell you, folks.
At M7, we had the girls' bathroom and the boys' bathroom that was supposed to be designated, because the main bathroom was supposed to be the one that the boys used, and then the outside one was the one that the girls used. But then all the boys started pooping in the girls' bathroom because it was more isolated. So our bathroom was infiltrated by y'all.
Oh, poop talk.
Good times. Good times.
Well, I'm excited about our guest today. She is a very accomplished woman and she knows so much. So I'm just really excited to get her on and just start firing questions at her. She wrote a book called There Are No Stupid Questions. And so we're going to have her on next and just start picking her brain.
This is another one of those people that I completely stalked. She came up in my feed and I started following her and I'm like, oh my God, I love this person. I am such a fangirl. She's so smart. She's so cool. She knows everything. I'm going to get her on the podcast. So started slipping into those DMs going, dude,
you got a problem. I need to know you. I think you have a problem. We need to talk.
I do. When I want something, I'm going to get it. And today we're getting Leah Ellison, science communicator, scientist, author, and all around badass. She'll be up after the break.
Carrie, have we not tested some crazy myths on Mythbusters?
Yeah, definitely.
So when we were testing the smell of fear, I remember back then, I wish I had had a better deodorant because I was sweating so bad and the smell was not pleasant.
We all wished that, actually, Tori. I think we all wished that.
You know what? If I had had Mando back then, I would have been completely covered and I would have spared you guys all.
You want to know a secret? I don't like the smell of girly ones, so I am actually wearing some right now. They sent a box for us to try, and I know I was supposed to like give to a guy I was dating or something like that, but no, I actually, I just put it on. I want to try it. I like those like earthy smells.
Ever since Mando, I have not had to reapply the deodorant over and over all day, especially doing the podcast. I put it on once and I'm done.
God, I wish we had a sponsorship for Mando back when we were on Mythbusters. At least one of our cast members could have really used it. I'm not gonna name names, but there is at least one of our cast members.
Are you talking about Buster?
Yeah, I'm talking about Buster. Let's go with that.
You know, I think out of all the products in the box, my favorite is the body spray.
Well, what's the smell for that? What flavor are you today?
It's whiskey and leather.
Ooh.
And it just, I spray it on. It smells good. It makes me feel good. This isn't your typical deodorant. It is clinically tested. And it is 2 times more effective than your typical deodorant.
All right, so Mando is deodorant re-engineered to stop odor before it starts, which means that it doesn't just mask the odor, it's supposed to prevent it. So 100% of participants experienced an all-day odor protection. That's all day. Mando's starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid deodorant stick, cream tube deodorant, and two free products of your choice, like a mini body wash or deodorant wipes, and free shipping. And as a special offer for our listeners, new customers get 20% off site-wide with our exclusive code. Use code MYTHFITS. That's MYTHFITS.
Again, that is shopmando.com. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Mando's got you covered. With deodorant plus sweat control, say goodbye to sweat and stains and say hello to long-lasting freshness.
I can smell you now, Tori.
Yeah, baby.
Hey, MythFits, welcome back. I'm really excited for our next guest because she has been in my social media feed for a while now. It is author, science communicator, scientist, Leah Elson, possibly future astronaut.
Oh, hopefully. We'll see. Thank you. Thank you. I wanted to start this out by saying what a full circle moment this is, because I used to watch Mythbusters growing up, and I don't know if the two of you realize probably how many formative years you molded and how many science communicators you probably sparked, you know, through the course of the filming. I mean, absolutely. It's one of my fondest things. I used to watch with my dad.
That's awesome.
I told my dad I was coming on the show, and he was like, really?
So, how yeah. cool is that?
So I got cool points with my dad, just so you know.
Nice. Hey, you're one of those people that I had, like, you know, when the Instagram suggests who you should follow, like I follow a lot of really cool women in space or just smart women, and like you came up. So like AI knows that you're somebody who I'd be friends with.
You've got an algorithm curated, obviously.
Yes. So, you know, I've been following you and hearing, you know, you're an author of a book, There Are No Stupid Questions, and you address so many different interesting things about science, but you recently announced that you are going to try to train to become an astronaut.
That's correct. So I'm putting my hat in the ring in the next round. For anybody out there also aspiring to space, NASA typically opens up astronaut candidacy once every 4 years. So next month, they're announcing their brand new class, and the next round is in 2028. And so, yeah, it's incredibly competitive, but it's an honor to even be eligible, honestly, to apply for the position.
So how are you training for that?
Well, right now, I mean, a lot of it is kind of staying the course. Aspects of what I'm doing academically involve intimately astronaut health, specifically nerve damage in astronauts, which is currently unrecognized. So I'm sort of the one out there with a sign like, hey, I think this is an issue that we should look into. And so I'm doing that. But a lot of it, too, is, you know, ensuring that I'm operationally trained, because they don't just need scientists. They need scientists that can be reliable crew members when life and death is on the line. So a lot of it is, you know, wilderness first responder training. I already do a lot of like off trail, solo, multi-day backpacking trips, things like that. But mostly just trying to be somebody that if you were sitting across from me and you knew your life was in my hands, you would be okay with.
So you think we did make it to the moon?
We did.
Just kidding.
You know,
just kidding.
We made it on the back lot anyway. You know what I mean? We made
Kubrick
it in 4K.
Kubrick is a hell of a director.
Oh, man, he's wonderful.
What did you go to school for, and when did you decide to become a science communicator?
Oh, geez. Interesting question. So I went to school originally, and it may make a little sense. I have the gift of gab, and I originally, when I was in college, I started sportscasting. And so I was doing sort of a journalistic focus. And my dad got incredibly sick. He got cancer, and he had these battery of surgeries that were happening back to back, you know, and watching him go through that was very sobering. And I kid you not, it was one of those sort of canon moments where I was on the sidelines of a football field, and I have an earpiece in, and the producer's counting me down from the van. And we're about to go live, and I'm sitting there holding the mic, and I have this footage somewhere, and I'm live, and I just remember thinking, what am I doing with my life right now? I could be doing something so much more impactful. So I pivoted out, and then ended up pursuing science. And so I went to Harvard to do all of my undergraduate sciences, because at that point I had sunk a bunch of time into journalism. So I did a hard pivot and threw my hat in the ring for Harvard and got like the thin envelope from Harvard. So they gave me the head fake and I was like, well, this is expected. And I actually put the acceptance letter down and came back to it like a day later and opened it up like, okay, let's see. Like I can frame a Harvard rejection. That's kind of a flex. And then I read it through and it was like, blah, blah, blah. We're pleased doing it. And I was like, wait, hey, hang on. What? And
yes. Amazing.
It was wild. It was real wild. That's actually the letter right here on the back wall. That's the actual letter.
Awesome.
Nice. That I received. I would frame it as well. So you're a Harvard graduate. You are a journalist. And you are way more qualified to be a Mythbuster than Tori and I.
Totally.
I don't know about that.
So I was watching an interview you had, and one of the questions is, why is blood red? And you explained it that, you know, there's iron in our blood and it oxidizes and turns red. But then you continued on octopus, that the octopus blood is bluer because it's a copper-based blood. Do you think they're aliens? Because their DNA doesn't match anything else on planet Earth.
They're fascinating. There's so many strange questions about cephalopods. You know, they're so brilliant. And it's one of those things where anytime I go into a sushi restaurant, I immediately feel so guilty because they're so sentient and you see their little tentacles. You're like, oh, my God.
And they're so delicious.
I know.
So I can't eat them. I can't do it.
Listen, somebody has a moral compass in this room. And Tori, it's not you or I, obviously.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've been accused of that in a while.
Well, I'm your reprieve today. It's the idea of panspermia, which is something being seeded from another planet and essentially starting life. You know, that's it starts with. I think cephalopods would be I don't know how that they would hold up to being careened through the atmosphere because that, you know, they're so gelatinous. But I think tardigrades are a good creature in the running for if, say, a meteor hit Earth and to seed.
What's a tardigrade?
Oh, man. So a tardigrade, these are, you might have heard them called colloquially water bears. They're these little, they're microscopic animals. They're in an animal kingdom. And they're pudgy, okay. And they have like multiple, they're little animals. Some of them are carnivorous. Some of them eat plants. Some of them eat other tardigrades. But the crazy thing about tardigrades is that they are so resilient. They have been boiled in alcohol, survived. They've been frozen, survived. They thawed them out and then they'd started immediately eating and acting like nothing's happening. They have been even more exotically shot out of a gun into like a sandbag backdrop to see if they could withstand a lot of impact, and they can. Yeah. So they check all these boxes like extreme temperature, impact, that if you think about it characteristically, they would have theoretically survived a potential meteor impact with Earth. And I mean, they live in permafrost, they live in the oceans, they live in every body of water, they live on land. And so it's very possible.
That's cool.
You just gave me the aliens. Most. Yeah, I have the biggest belief. I feel like you just X-filed me. Like, I believe
I just
in aliens
you.
Now.
Yep,
that is amazing.
I just accepted you. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
They're so wild. They're so cool. Oh, and they can survive the vacuum of space. You stick them up in the vacuum of space and they're chilling. They're great.
Basically aliens.
They're basically
aliens. That would have been a good Mythbuster episode if we could have just got some and tried all those different, because we have definitely tried every one of those situations.
Oh, absolutely. And you can harvest them pretty easily. Like if you take moss, like if you got like moss growing in the backyard and you soak it in water overnight and you kind of squeeze it out, you'll be able to find them. You plate some of that they're everywhere. They're like ubiquitous.
All right. I have a question about useless body parts. We have so many useless body parts. It's like our tonsils, our appendix, tailbone, your wisdom teeth. Like, why do we have so much extra stuff that we don't use anymore?
I think a lot of it is just a product of the way that the environment develops around us and what it is we need. I mean, tailbones, they're shrinking slowly over time because if you trace us back far enough in lineage, you know, we had a common ancestor that may have had a tail that was used to help sort of navigate arboreally. Wisdom teeth are interesting, actually. As our diets get softer, our palates get narrower, and so our teeth get more crowded. So maybe as we were chewing on tubers and roots, it expanded our palates. We had more room for teeth back in the day. And I'm actually going to contest your appendix claim because recently we think that the appendix is actually not vestigial, and there's a cool use for it. It's almost like a little slightly deflated balloon, but it is packed with bacteria. And the gut microbiome is actually so essential for human health that a lot of people speculate that it's almost like a little reserve store. So if you get wiped out, like let's say antibiotics, or you get sick or inflammation, something wipes out your gut microbiome, you have a little store that can go and reseed for you.
Look at that.
Fun fact.
Are you actually AI? How do you have the answer to every single question?
Carrie, I don't actually have friends. I don't have friends. That's the answer.
I actually giggle every time I hear the word tailbone because I played, this is why you have children, I played the long con prank on my daughter that her whole life I told her she was born with a tail and that to make her normal, we cut it off at birth, but she was born with a tail. And I, to prove that, I told her that, you know, ask anybody in our family, anybody, if you were born with a tailbone. And so she went around until she was about, I think she was about 8 or 9 years old. And we were walking through a museum and some docent said something about seeing the tailbone on a statue. She turned around and looked at me with the betrayal and horror my on gosh. Her face. Just what? And I just fell over laughing. It was a 9-year prank. That poor child.
That's phenomenal.
You're going to be paying for that in therapy sessions for sure.
She will.
I bet she had that like 1,000-yard stare and it just was replaying all the conversations she had had on the playground about her tail through the years, you know, and she's traumatized for life.
I know she asked grandpa, she's asked aunts and uncles, like legit. She was like, was I born with a tailbone? They're like, yeah.
Of course. I love that everyone was unknowingly in on the prank too, just by giving objective information. And I feel like that's how you know you're winning as a parent, to be honest.
What's the most mind-blowing fact that you've learned over your career that you still, it still like makes you stop and go, wow, how does that work? Or how did that happen?
That the conceptualization of what we know as the universe is colloquially called the observable universe. And that's only because we have a limit to how far we can observe based on how long photons have to travel. Beyond that threshold, we can't see anything. So our knowledge of the limit of the quote-unquote universe is actually just what is observed. So we have no idea, is the universe infinite? Is there anything outside of that? Is everything that we can see, is there another universe outside of that? We will never know. We will never, no matter how good our technology gets, that is the cosmic speed limit, and we will never see it beyond that.
That's what I love about science is the ever-changing definition of it by what we can actually discover.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's why science is so important, because it's, I call it the grand equalizer, right? Because the staggering reality of, you know, the fact that we're just this little nothing corner of the universe that has coalesced enough to recognize itself. We are all nothing. We are all equal under the gravity of what that implies, right? You know, and so I think if more people knew more about just what's out there, I think there would be probably less interpersonal nastiness.
We're always taught that space is infinite, but you're right, if we can only observe so far, we don't really know how far it goes. I mean, it makes me feel like, are we in a simulation? Like, is this reality? I don't know. It messes with my mind. But I'm curious, what are your thoughts on what if we're all just in a giant simulation?
I love these questions because, I mean, really, the sky is kind of the limit conceptually. I think there's an interesting theory. It's thin. I've talked about it a little bit. There's an interesting theory that maybe we're inside of a black hole. And like inside of black holes, there's just enough matter and things dumped in to make a new universe. There's an equation called the Schwarzschild radius. And it's essentially describes the amount of mass of a black hole is proportional to what its radius will be. So the more mass you stick inside of a black hole, the larger it will become. And interestingly enough, if you calculate the mass of our observable universe, you get a radius on orders of magnitude that is similar to what you would expect of a black hole. And so some people are like, that's a really cool math trick. Like, does that mean we're inside of a black hole? And so we call that black hole cosmology. And so a lot of people will lean on the mathematics, but there's that little weird similarity.
We're all in a black hole. I don't know. It's breaking my brain.
So we might be in the Matrix, Tori. I recently sent Tori this like thing I saw that in China, they have robots that are going to be able to gestate babies now. Like they like if they can do for that, fuel? I feel like next step
for fuel batteries,
you know, like for batteries. Matrix. Yeah, Boston Dynamics, the robotics company.
Oh
they
my
were
God,
they were
terrifying.
Still. I know. When I was at Harvard, they were still working out of their garage and they were putting up YouTube videos and they were like, you know, on old potato phones. And it was like Whoa. Just the group of kids. And they were right across the river at MIT. And so everybody at Harvard and MIT, we knew who they were and we all followed them. They had like 600 followers or something. And, you know, you think about then what you would foresee for that company even, you know, and it's just right. It's skyrocketed so quickly. Or Clone Robotics. Have you guys seen... Mm-hmm. Those eerie videos of their robotics suspended and they have
it's like muscles almost. It's
yeah exactly.
It looks like tendons, like they're all twitching and oh
it does. And they've modeled, they actually have a lot of the major organ systems, like functionally they have like a nervous system that has been yeah. predicated on the human nervous system. They have the same number of bones and articulating joints. They have the same sort of like muscle contracture moment arms and things like that physically. It's very wild. And like 3 years ago, all they had was a prototyped hand and now they have a full body and it's amazing.
What is your thoughts on the way that this technology, especially with AI and the robotics, how quickly it's just evolving and getting better? And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the future. Is this a good path that we're going down or is this going to end bad?
So I think when a lot of people have this question, I think the first thing they're thinking of is Skynet and Terminator. They're like, how, you know, like, right? am I going to have to punch a robot for fresh water? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But I think really the biggest issue that not a lot of people talk about is that the more elegant and the more comprehensive that these systems become, the more automated human tasks become. And so it's not going to be a takeover by force. I think it's potentially a human takeover by attrition, because there will come a time in which most human jobs are irrelevant because AI and robotics can do it better, faster, smarter, more accurately, more efficiently. And so then it becomes, well, what do you do? Like, what is a human's purpose on Earth? And that's a very, that's a very existential crisis. And so one of the things, you know, that Elon Musk has suggested is that people, if you're a human, you have a universal salary. Like humans just get a salary by virtue of the fact that they're a human, because there will be no jobs available for them in the future. And so I know there are talks about that. It is very weird. So I think it's less Terminator, less like, you know, metal morphing through cage bars. Yeah. And more, I think it's more a crippling, like philosophic existential crisis that we're facing that no one's ready for. And it's already upon us. It's already coming.
What do you think about all these sightings, all these, they're no longer UFOs. Now they're,
UAPs.
UAPs. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think it's from another planet, another dimension, or are they, you know, military?
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people would say, oh, you know, it's military technology from a different country. But if you look at the budget that America has on defense, and then you have fighter pilots that are like, I've never seen this technology in my life,
right.
You know, and you look at the scale of who invests in their military, like rank wise, we're so far ahead of everybody else. So you're thinking if there was some sort of like new kid on the block in military wise, we might recognize some of that technology. But some of the movement, you know, you think about like the Tic Tac video, the famous...
Yep.
The famous Tic Tac that they were locked onto, and they had these fighter pilots who've seen it all, done it all, that were speechless. It's fascinating. I mean, it makes you wonder. And you think if something had the ability to travel here, which is light years worth of time, that technology would be so developed that it's possible that, you know, perhaps we wouldn't notice. But then again, you know, I know we've got a pretty solid we've got a pretty solid camera system, I guess, for lack of a better term, around the U.S. So it's
right.
It's strange. But, you know, you think about these sightings and then you're like, now everybody has cell phones. Like, why aren't we seeing this huge influx, you know, if they're really that pervasive? So it's
right.
I don't know. It's interesting. I think it's fascinating.
There used to be a Department of Misinformation as well. So yeah. Like they used to plant these ideas to you know, put Russia off thinking that we were developing one thing when we were actually doing another. So I wouldn't doubt that kind of thing still exists. Like,
exactly.
Over
Exactly. I had heard something the other day that Congress had said, yeah, a lot of the UAP things that we had put out, it turns out that they were part of a program, like a counterintelligence program or something like that. So yeah, it makes you wonder. But insofar as whether or not there are other civilizations, I mean, I think that if you look at the scope of how large the observable universe is, you know, how relatively young our solar system is comparatively, and how many stars have planets, and now the James Webb is just, I mean, it's picking up new exoplanets day by day, you know what I mean? And so the odds are staggering that we're the only ones out there. But
except for the little critters that we've got now inside of our moss.
Well, you know, I think what's really fascinating is that there's actually, we don't know yet, and this is like one of those like mind blowers, we can't even confirm yet that there's not life in our own solar system. You know, we've never sampled. And so we have these interesting areas that could harbor life, right? Like Europa, that's a moon that is, it's close enough to its parent planet that it has these gravity shifts that keeps the water, the salty water, liquid instead of freezing since it's so far from the sun. And I mean, its oceans are way deeper than Earth's. And we're like, there might be something if you plunge a camera down in there that swims up to the lens. You know what I mean? You just don't know. We have no idea to know yet. We can't even confirm that there is nothing or was nothing on Mars yet. So
would you ever take a mission that you were never coming? Like, let's say you're going to Mars.
Yes.
To start a colony. Would you and you knew you were never coming back to Earth.
Yes, I would.
Wow.
And it's a big thing to say, but the personal ethos that has guided my life is that I wanted to make the maximal impact possible on human life with the limited time that I have. And, you know, that is the thing about astronauts in general and the idea of being an astronaut. It's one of those things where the term seems very rock star and it's like, oh, you know, astronaut. And it's like, I'm going to go do this astronaut thing. But it's a lot of embracing the suck. It's not, you know, when you get there, it's not glamorous. It's being isolated in a tin can, you know, the moon is our closest thing that we're aiming for. And it's 250,000 miles away from Earth. It's a lot of isolation. It's a lot of psychological strain. It's a lot of being with the same people doing the same monotonous thing day after day after day.
But you're really selling it.
I'm really selling it. Yeah. So for anybody there who was thinking about going to space, but that's the reality of it, you know? And so for something like starting a colony, what that would represent is a lot of personal sacrifice, but it would open up the channel for human beings to be interplanetary, which, I mean,
right.
What else is there apart from like sacrificing for other people? You know what I mean? In such an impactful way.
Tori, would you go up even just, would you be a space tourist or would you go up into space?
Yeah, I would be a space tourist, but I want to come back. Like I don't think I could do that. Just leave Earth forever and just be like, okay, I'm off this planet. I'm probably going to die on this other planet. I don't know.
I don't even like being on vacation for too long.
You know, I think that there shouldn't be an intent to have personnel up there without the intent to return. Now, the Mars missions will be quite long because I think right now with current rocketry, it would take 9-ish months to get there. So that's one way. So you're talking about 9 months there, 9 months back, and then you have a mission to complete on surface. So the first missions will probably be 3 years long, you know?
Wow. God, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time.
I work with a lot of kids for the National STEM Festival, and I noticed that they always ask some of the most similar questions when they're talking to astronauts. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you're just not ready for in your training. For example, how do you poop in space? I have heard that when you're a new guy, that they haze you and not tell you how the toilet works just to see if you can figure it out. Are you ready for this kind of thing? And what is the most, what is the one thing that you're kind of like, oh no, do I have to do that?
You know, if I am lucky enough to kind of carry that honorable torch to represent humanity, I will gladly be hazed with the strange, complicated toilet space station. For anybody that doesn't know that, so there is let's see, how do we put this very delicately? There is a physics associated with going number two on Earth, right? And there's a sort of a gravity oriented disengagement process, we'll call it, right?
Well done. Well done.
Politely said.
Very politely, right? See, look at NASA, if you're listening to this, see how well media trained I am already? So there's a sort of a disengagement process into the receptacle, but you obviously don't have that in microgravity on the space station. And so there is this sort of suction blender mechanism that helps. And because you're floating around, there's also like a seat belt, you know, to kind of strap you into the apparatus. So it's like an entire thing. And then, you know, for the purposes of keeping everything very sterile, because obviously if you're blending something like human waste in zero gravity, it's going to just disperse and aerosolize, right? So there's like this very hefty suction. And the funny thing is that it actually took a lot of iterations to get this right. So there were a lot of the early generation astronauts who had to contend with toilets breaking, things being aerosolized, like things. So there's some pretty non-glamorous aspects of that part of space.
Oh, man, I can't wait to apply.
I know. There's also space diapers. So the EVA suits, they kind of just wear like big absorbent space diapers if they have to be, because EVA walks and actually like conducting repairs and things on the space station now, they're quite long. You know, they can be like 6-8 hours long. And so you're hooked up in a diaper up there in your big EVA suit. So
that's crazy.
Very fun. Very fun.
I don't know, I've peed in my wetsuit before. I feel like I could do that part.
Listen, I know. I'm like, if you're a surfer, that's delightful. That's warm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can heat you up for a few minutes. So you were talking about nerve regeneration. You're working on that. Explain how that works. Is it even possible?
Absolutely. So I think it's something that people get confused about, because a lot of people will say, oh, you know, nerve regeneration is impossible. I have an uncle who's paralyzed, you know, or something, and it's not possible. So there are actually two separate sort of segmented pieces of your nervous system at large. There's the central nervous system, which is the brain and the spinal cord. And then there's the peripheral nervous system, which are all the nerves that innervate your arms, your hands, your organs, everything that you feel, touch, smell, you know, that's all going through peripheral nerves back to your brain for interpretation. Now, the central nervous system is a very, very difficult beast to regenerate and repair. There are a lot of things that make the central nervous system get in its own way. So one of them is that the central nervous system lacks support cells that help it to regenerate. It just doesn't have them, whereas the peripheral nervous system does. In the peripheral nervous system, they're called Schwann cells, and they help tremendously with the regrowth process. And then the central nervous system has all of these inhibitory molecules. Like, it's just sort of built to not fix itself once it's broken. Now, the peripheral nervous system, on the other hand, is not the case. So I think a lot of people hear that you can't repair the spinal cord, and they assume that applies to all nerves in general, but this is not the case. The peripheral nervous system, you can actually sew together nerves. So if you, let's say you're slicing an avocado in your hand, I've seen a lot of people use their hand as a cutting board, and then they slip. And you see this a lot, and they actually call it in the space avocado hand, where you'll see like a knife go through the hand, and they kind of walk in with just the butt end of a knife sticking out of their hand. And you'll sever a bunch of nerves, and those nerves can actually be repaired. There are sutures that are finer than a human hair. And you either look at it under a microscope, or you look at it under a set of loops, and you can actually physically repair them. And the actual, if you think of peripheral nerves like an electrical wire, they have insulation, right? That insulation is called myelin. And then the axons are sort of like the copper wiring in the middle. And so that copper wiring will actually reconnect itself across small distances. If you can kind of help it along, if you sew it back together, it'll remake that connection. Wow. And there's also, you know, ways right now in which groups are looking at sort of turning on the good things about the peripheral nervous system that make it grow, you know, utilizing things called nerve growth factor, which is these molecules that signal to the nerve like, hey, it's time to grow right now. It's time to go find your home. And seeing, you know, can we apply this to nerve? Can we inject it near nerve? Does it help it grow? Does it encourage the process? But in my line of work, the beauty is that, you know, there have been people that have come in with, let's say, a traumatic hand injury, and we've not only been able to, you know, help surgeons understand how to reconnect those nerves, but the patients have full function afterward. They have full sensation, one big issue with women that undergo radical mastectomy is that their chest wall becomes completely numb. And that's a really terrible quality of life hit because you can't, for the rest of your life, feel a hug. You know, you can't, if something is hot near your chest, you drop something hot, you know, you can't feel it. And so it will just cause tissue damage. So we have actually done an extensive amount of work with breast reconstruction surgeons to get those nerves to regrow so that you can start to feel the chest wall again. And so that's been a huge thing. So nerve repair and regeneration in the peripheral nervous system is absolutely possible. And people like me work every day to identify patients that desperately need intervention in nerve repair. And we find them, we work with their surgeons, and we try to make it possible.
When I was a kid, I was maybe about 13 years old, and my dad and I were working in a kitchen, like a close quarters kitchen. And I turned to him to ask where something was, and he was holding his knife. And I like smacked my finger on the knife, and I had like, you know, 12 stitches, and it was just, I was like, ah. And it's still to this day, the tip is numb. Like,
yeah,
it's crazy.
Digital nerves are probably some of the most common nerves that we work with surgeons to help repair. We actually, as part of the biotech company I work for, we hold big courses where we bring in a bunch of new fellows and brand new surgeons, kind of fresh out of residency, going into their own practice. And we sit there and we teach them how to repair nerves in microsurgery. I'm looking at right now, I have a little microsurgical repair kit and like loops so that I sit and practice. And a funny analog, if you ever wanted to practice like sewing nerves or vessels together, if you're out there and you're like a pre-med or something like that, or you're 10 years old and you want to learn how to do this one day, chicken thighs, you can actually find the nerve and the vessel in a chicken thigh from the store. Uh-huh. Yeah. And you can go through and you can find them. They're near the bone and you'll see them, they look like little white pipes, and you can cut them with scissors and you can actually work to sew them together. They make a great analog for human tissue.
Learning
new things every day.
I was going to say, now the next time you have a bone-in chicken thigh, you're going to see it and you're going to be like, oh my gosh, Leah has ruined this for me for the rest of my life.
Oh my God, I got to repair this chicken's thigh.
This is a nerve. This patient needs
Maybe you can help Tori with that finger of his.
I got you, Tori. Done.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the MythFit community is going to want to watch you and support you on your journey, because how long do you have before you can apply?
So the next round of applications for anybody who's also interested in applying opens up in probably about 2.5 years, sometime in spring of 2028.
So we can follow you. Gnarly by Nature is your handle. Are there any other places where we can follow you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok posting science content. And that's primarily my public outreach. And I'm always on there answering questions, answering your curious quandaries, folks. So please feel free to drop me a line.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's like, you've given us a lot to think about, and
you guys
so
were
much
delightful.
My brain hurts right now because these ideas are pretty far out.
I want to know.
Suddenly believe in aliens. Thank you very much.
I was going to say what I want to know. What scarred you guys the most? Was it the observable universe thing? Was it the tardigrades thing? Was it the chicken thigh nerve thing? I feel like
all the things.
Tardigrades.
All the things.
All the things. Fever dreams. Fever dreams.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. It was so much fun having this discussion, and you are a fascinating person, and good luck in your pursuit of becoming an astronaut.
Oh,
yeah. We want to keep up with you, and everybody follow Gnarly by Nature on Instagram.
Oh, thank you guys so much. It was awesome. Thank you for having me on the show.
My brain hurts.
Right? She broke our brains.
Everything.
She's not that smart. I noticed. My God. It's like talking to an encyclopedia.
It's like we found our next gen Neil deGrasse Tyson. Like you, there was not a question you could throw at her that she didn't have an answer to.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
It was amazing.
I was very excited for this. This was a great interview.
That was awesome. And it's like, God, just some of the concepts or the theories, it melts your brain. Anyway, now it's time on the show where we take one of your questions and answer it. Are you ready for this, Carrie?
I am.
So this comes from Osef Svensson. Is that how you pronounce it? The question is this. Have you ever heard the narrator for the European version of MythBusters?
There's a different narrator than Rob?
Oh, yeah.
I did not know that.
They also, fun fact, they dub in our voices. I got a call from a buddy who was in Mexico, and he like, he's like, dude, I didn't know you spoke Spanish so fluently. But it was like super like, hola, señor, mito, busty. Like it was a very deep, way deeper voice, but we were all dubbed. And your voice was like super, hey.
I've heard it. I was in Costa Rica, and I was, Mythbusters came on TV. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even know they played that here. But what is that voice? And I actually, at one point, I met one of the people that played me as the voice actor.
Oh, that's
and like they're like, cool. This was great. I had a steady job for a long time.
Wow.
Isn't that cool? It was so weird. It was very meta.
I've never heard the European voice, but it would be funny to get all the, because the show was global, to go around and see which, you know, all the different versions of our voices. That would be hilarious.
Yeah, it's so strange. So many different countries. It was everywhere. I remember I went to Russia mm-hmm. to do sort of a PR thing. And I was like, Mythbusters is huge here. I mean, when I was in, I went to Warsaw to do something and got chased down the street like a beetle.
You were like the Beatles, man.
They had a giant science picnic, and we did like a little stage show, and I was assigned a security guard, like this big buff dude. And I had brought along, you know, I had a handler, I had the security guard, and then I brought my best friend because I'm just like, oh, I got a plus one. You want to go to Poland? Let's go. So she and the handler were standing back, and all of a sudden the crowd started pushing in because I was signing autographs. I mean, I've never experienced anything like this before. This was wild. Like, we were way bigger there than we were here. Pushing in, and then I started to walk away because I was like, oh my God, this is getting intense, and started getting followed. And they were like chasing us to the point where I had to ditch the handler. I had to ditch Brittany, and the security guard, he was like special forces, huge guy. He threw me over his shoulder and hopped a fence. And
oh my gosh.
I was just texting like, we'll find you later. Like,
oh my God, that's crazy.
Crazy.
Oh, good times. Good times in Poland. Carrie's big in Poland. We're huge in Poland. Well, this was fun. I'm glad we got to talk to Leah. She was awesome.
Yeah, totally. If you guys have more questions, we think this would be really fun to incorporate some video or some audio to this.
Yeah, so send your questions in video form. That way we can get you on the show. How cool would that be? That'd be fun.
Yeah, I think you can, it's at MythFitsPodcast on Instagram. You can send us an audio clip or a video clip of yourself, and we'll answer these questions to you directly.
Sweet. All right, everybody. Well, thank you again for listening. Carrie, good to see you again.
Please like, follow, subscribe, tell all your friends, and definitely come back next week.
Pioneer.